This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
This is Bart Peterson, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This is Greg Gilchrist, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This is Dan DeMarco, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
We take a little bit different approach on this episode as I interview Dave Lefort. Dave is the editor-in-chief at Compliance Week, but our topic is the recently passed away Tommy Heinsohn, longtime Boston Celtic player, coach, and announcer. We take a look at some compliance and leadership issues through the lens of Tommy Heinsohn's life and what he meant to not only Boston, Massachusetts, and New England, but both to Dave and myself. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I have a very special treat for you today. Number one, because I have Dave Lefort. Dave is the editor-in-chief at Compliance Week. First of all, Dave, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to visit with me.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
And our podcast topic today is not precisely on compliance, although we may touch on it, but for probably a quarter of the nation, you will love this podcast. A quarter of the nation will hate this podcast. Probably half will be neutral, but we're going to get some conversation going, and that is I wanted to do a tribute to the recently deceased Tommy Heinsohn. And Dave, longtime Boston Celtics fan. And
I've seen plenty of, plenty of highlight reels. And, of course, you know, he would almost on almost every broadcast bring up, you know, back when I played, or, you know, me and Russell would have done it this way, or me and Kuz would have done it that way. And so, you know, I got to know Tommy as a broadcaster more than anything else.
He is one of the rare individuals who spent literally his entire life with one franchise, professional life. But even rarer, he spent not his playing life, but his professional life thereafter. He became a Celtics coach. He became a Celtics broadcaster. I knew Tommy in each one of those phases of his career, a little bit as a player, very little bit, more as a coach, and then as a broadcaster as well. But I just wanted to really explore his place in the Boston sports pantheon and how Boston feels about Tommy Heinsohn. And we can wrap that around the Celtics. We can wrap that around Boston sports and you guys' well-known loyalty. Some might even say fanaticism. But I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about the basketball history of Tommy Heinsohn.
Yeah, so Tommy, he was born in Jersey, but really that's the born and raised in Jersey, but then spent really all of his career in the Massachusetts area, most of it in Boston. He went to Holy Cross in the early 50s, sort of just before Bob Cousy also went to Holy Cross, was drafted in by the Celtics in the mid 50s, only played the game for 9 years, believe it or not. A guy who's been the only person that's been part of all 17 Celtics championships. He only actually played the game in the NBA with the Celtics for 9 years. Of course, they won championships 8 of those years, but he retired after 9. Some say it's because he had bad knees. Others blame, a really two-pack-a-day smoking habit, which back then was more the norm than I guess in today's world. But only spent 9 years playing the game. After that, actually very briefly became an insurance salesman until he was sort of talked out of insurance and talked back into the NBA by, one of his mentors, Red Auerbach, who also famously coached the Celtics himself and was the architect of most of their championships. He coached the Celtics for about 10 years, led him to 2 more championships. And then after that, he became a broadcaster, and this was like in the early 80s, became a broadcaster, would broadcast off and on, and then really became a regular on Celtics broadcast in the 90s until, recently even. I mean, last couple of years, you know, he had been sick and had done much less on the broadcast. But, you know, me growing up, I'm in my mid-40s. I remember Tommy as a mainstay on the on Celtics broadcast. And he was the one that made the Celtics relatable. He was passionate, more passionate than any fan. And, you know, he was, I guess, sort of proudly biased, in the sense that when he saw something that didn't go the Celtics' way, he would yell and scream just like he was coaching on the sidelines. He would mostly his ire was mostly directed toward the refs. Every call, according to Tommy, was a bad call. And you know, he let them know it as a coach, as a player, and then, you know, obviously as a broadcaster. But that's what made him relatable to Boston fans, and it sort of endeared him to Boston fans that everyone knew that he was incredibly biased toward the Celtics, but that's why we loved him. He bled green just like we did. And, you know, he was fantastic in really every phase of his career. But the only one that I can really speak to is that as of a commentator, because to a whole generation or several generations of Celtics fans, he was the voice of the Celtics. And that's, you know, that's something that was pretty special, particularly, you know, in the '80s as Larry Bird was coming up. And then, you know, just recently he was the guy calling all the games for, I guess the new big three, the Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce Celtics when they were made their runs. So, you know, Tommy was someone that meant a lot to me and to really to all Celtics fans.
Dave, I wanted to go over some numbers because you touched on some of them, but some of them I thought were just incredible. I wanted to start with Holy Cross. His sophomore year, he took Holy Cross to the NIT Finals back when it was at least as big as the NCAA Finals in 1952. He left Holy Cross after you know, playing out his 3 years of eligibility with 1,789 points. His first year as a Celtic, he scored 37 points in the Game 7. Double time win over Atlanta to bring the Celtics their first title. He retired averaging 18.6 points a game and 8.8 rebounds, having played the 9 years. The 17 titles, so that's the number that just is the most amazing to me. That seven, not that the Celtics have won 17 titles is amazing, but that he was involved in every one of them. And he's the only person to have been involved in every one of them, either as a player, coach, or announcer. And that just speaks to a relationship, a level of consistency that, like I said, we don't see too much anymore. I was introduced to Tommy Heinsohn for the most basic reason possible. When I was a kid, I was a Tommy, and he was the only Tommy in the NBA. So he was my man, Tommy Heinsohn, Tommy Fox. And I developed a hook shot based on him.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so I love Tommy Heinsohn. And I really came to know him when he was a coach. He won, I believe, in titles in 74 and 76. This was an era of very different basketball, but there was a guy who used to be named Lou Alcindor, and the Celtics would play him with a guy named Dave Cowens. And Dave Cowens was a 6'8" center, and he could hold his own with 7'2" Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. As he became. And those were some of the greatest battles I ever saw, those two. And I think they had a level of basketball respect for each other. But I wanted to also move into a little bit of leadership, because one of the things in researching Tommy for this podcast that struck me was that his relationship with Red Auerbach, perhaps one of the greatest coaches ever, and if not the greatest coach in the NBA, certainly top one or two. And Red used Tommy in different ways in different parts of his career. And the vision that Red had to be able to see Tommy as obviously a great player, even if he was two-pack-a-day Tommy. But after he left, to bring him back as an announcer and to see something that Red thought was important to bring to the announcing booth, but then to move him from the announcing booth into the coaching chair. He did fire Tommy from the coaching chair, but then he hired him back into announcing. And so I was wondering if you might have any thoughts about kind of the role of a general manager as opposed to a coach, How does a general manager see different aspects of a player's talent the player might see? And what did you see about that relationship?
Yeah, so, I mean, Red was really both way back when. He was he coached the Celtics. He was also the GM. He was sort of Mr. Celtic. But initially, Red's relationship with Tommy was really as Red's punching bag. Because I don't know if many people know this, but Tommy was started in the NBA, drafted on the regional draft the same year as Bill Russell. And Tommy actually beat out Russell for Rookie of the Year that year, mostly because Russell didn't start in the NBA until December that year because he was playing in the Olympics. So, I mean, Russell was clearly a better player. However, so on that within that team, Red saw each of them as having a different role. So as Tommy would explain it is, Tommy was the punching bag. So Red would yell at Russell, and Tommy would say, why aren't you yelling at me? He said, because Russell's the best player on this team. He's our leader. So I can yell at you because I know you can take it. So they sort of started out with that kind of relationship. And then, you know, as Tommy explained it years and years later, it was that, you know, the thing that Red did to get the most out of his players is he let them sort of take ownership of some of the play calling and some of the strategy that would go on during the game. Like, you know, for example, he would, during a timeout, Red would say, anyone got any ideas? You know, anyone have any thoughts on what we can do out of this timeout? And so what that would do, as Tommy explained it, is that he knew that if a player suggested something, that they would try like hell to make it work because they sort of had pride of ownership in it. And so that is something that was a sort of a hallmark of Red's, is that he had this really gruff exterior, but, you know, to his players, he was everything. And to Tommy, he was everything. And like you said, even though Red, you know, actually fired him, Tommy, it was never personal. It was always sort of, Tommy was always a Celtic. He always saw Red as just doing his job, and came back to work for the Celtics after a player as a coach, and then after coaching, like you said, as a broadcaster. So they were Tommy and Red were very tight. It went so far as to, you know, there was a story that Tommy told again later in life about when Red led a group of NBA stars to Europe to play sort of a series of exhibition games after the U.S. college players got routed in various world championships and Olympics. Well, Red was saying, well, enough of that. They need to see how good we really are. So it was Tommy and Russell and, you know, a lot of the stars, NBA stars of that day, sort of like the first dream team. But they went over to Europe and they were in, I believe it was Poland. And Red had, this is according to Tommy, Red had told Heinsohn and a bunch of other guys, hey, you know what? Don't trade in your money on the black market because you can get a better rate in the black market. But, you know, do it legit or else there's going to be trouble. And so I guess Red must have known that Tommy ignored his advice and he got he exchanged his money on the black market. And then I guess that same day, Tommy gets a knock at his hotel room door. And I promise this will be a quick story. And it was these two large Polish official looking fellows that said, you know, Tommy, come with me. They took him down to the alley next to the hotel and into the adjacent building and told him to sit down in the chair in this dark room. And Tommy was like, I got to get the hell out of here. This, you know, something really bad's going to happen to me here. But then I guess, you know, Red came in and sort of, you know, revealed that the joke was on Tommy and that, you know, you hope you learned your lesson here. So they had that kind of relationship too. So, you know, it was very much mentor mentee.
Was that before or after the exploding cigar?
Oh, I don't know that one. You got to tell me that one. I don't know that one.
Oh, Tommy fixed up an exploding cigar and got it to Red. And it literally blew up in his face. So you're right. But both stories show the kind of relationship these guys had. I wanted to maybe change the focus a little bit to Tommy as a coach, because in looking back now, it seemed to me he was extraordinarily gifted tactically. And yes. When I saw him coach, and that he knew X's and O's of basketball because he had learned from the master. And is it the job of the coach to be a great tactician, but does a coach need to have that strategic vision or Much like a board of directors oversight above a CEO, can there be a level above a coach who's a great tactician, but someone else or a group of people bringing that kind of strategic oversight? How does you feel that works best in sports?
Well, I think with basketball in particular, a coach really has to do both. He needs to think strategically, but also has to be a master tactician. I'll give you a couple of examples. So Heinzen, back when he was a coach, and he used to say this over, and I know this because I've heard him say it over and over again in recent years, his strategy as a coach was, we're going to make sure to out-hustle, to outrun these teams. So when the other team would get a basket, whoever was closest to the basket would grab the ball and automatically start the fast break. So in other words, he would keep the defense on its heels. And that, in his eyes, gave his team a strategic advantage right off the bat on almost every possession. It also wore all his players out, but he didn't care about that. He just wanted the strategic advantage every time down the court. And what frustrated him was that in the modern NBA era, teams would, you know, as a broadcaster, he would interview coaches, he would interview players. You know, he knew everyone around the league. And, you know, he would talk to a coach and the coach would say, you know what, we're going to – you know, we're going to play really fast. We're going to hustle down the court. We're going to make it hell for the defenders to play like us. And Tommy would sort of, you know, roll his eyes a little bit, say, okay, all right, we'll see. And then, you know, what he would point out is that the coach would still have the big man on the floor take the ball out after a basket. So it wasn't the guy closest to the basket taking the ball out. It was still the big man having to walk down to the line, throw it into the point guard to dribble up court. And Tommy would say, by that time, you've already got four or five guys all the way down the court. So people would, you know, these coaches would say they're playing fast, but he would call BS because they would still, you know, they still weren't down the court nearly as fast as they could have been had they sort of thought outside the box a little bit. But also in today's NBA, you really have to think tactically. And, you know, the guy who does this the best is why am I blanking on his name now? Miami coach
Eric Spoelstra.
Right. Spoelstra. And as a Celtics fan, I watched this painfully in this past postseason. Is that Spoelstra had a guy, Duncan Robinson, who was a Division III player drafted recently. Guy out of Division III was playing against guys from Tufts, and I think he played for Williams. But he drafted him because he could shoot three pointers. He could shoot them quick. And he can shoot him with more accuracy than anyone else in collegially. And he said to Robinson, you're my guy. All right. When you're in the game, all I want you to do is post up behind that 3-point line and get it off as quickly as possible. And so he had a very specific role for Duncan Robinson. And in fact, he would penalize him if Robinson, say, you know, passed up an open three to either pass the ball to a teammate or try to drive to the hole. And so as a Celtics fan, you know, having all this explained to me, I had never heard of Duncan Robinson, but I saw him literally tear the Celtics limb from limb just by spotting up for open threes. And so that's a very specific skill set that someone like Spoelstra saw and said, like, okay, you know, not really thinking strategically, but thinking tactically in that sense that I'm going to use this guy off the bench and he's going to kill these other teams, and the Celtics wouldn't stop playing their zone defense. So this was Miami's answer to that. And again, that's just a long-winded example of how, you know, the smart coaches will think both strategically with the, okay, this is how we want the pace of the game to be, as Tommy did. Tommy was really big on pace, or tactically, or, you know, like an Eric Spoelstra, where he saw very specific roles for certain players to really take advantage of weaknesses that he saw in another team.
So let me change to maybe a broader Boston sports question. And why is continuity so valued, or sitting here in Texas, I perceive it to be so valued, not simply in Boston, not simply in Massachusetts, but really in all of New England. And I would throw in, of course, the Red Sox, Ted Williams from my generation, Carl Yastrzemski, others, but that really seems to be valued in your part of the country, and something that the Celtics fans, the Red Sox fans, Patriots came along in the 1960s, so didn't really have that tradition as much as well, but certainly the Patriots as well. Why do you feel that's so valued, Dave?
I think it's because, you know, continuity is only as good as what it brings with it. Like if it's, you know, for as a suffering Patriots fan growing up, the continuity meant nothing because Patriots were terrible. Like, I grew up in the 80s, and they were really never better than a, you know, 5-11 team or a 6-10 team. They made the Super Bowl 1 year in the mid-80s, but it, you know, didn't really pan out too much. But in New England anyway, continuity is associated with success. So you look at the Celtics of the 50s, late 50s, early 60s and 70s, where they won all those championships. Tommy was a big part of that. You look at the Patriots from the last 20 years. Literally, there's a whole generation of Patriots fans who have no idea what it's like to watch a really bad NFL team, except for this season when you're sort of without Tom Brady, who was that, you know, between, I guess, Brady and Belichick. They were part of that continuity of all those Patriots teams that went to the Super Bowl 9 years out of, I believe it was 18 or 19. Just an unbelievable number. Won 6 Super Bowls under Brady and Belichick. So the continuity in that sense really means success. Patriots fans knew year in and year out that you were getting right out of the gate. You had won the AFC East. It was only a matter of, are they going to reach the AFC Championship game? Are they going to reach the Super Bowl? Is this a Super Bowl winning team? And then with the Celtics, that continuity was Tommy. Tommy was really the one person that made those really awful Celtics teams of the early 2000s in the late 90s when, you know, the big three had all retired. And, you know, those Paul Pierce teams, I guess, where Pierce was great, but the Celtics really had nothing else. Tommy was focused on a guy named Walter McCarty, who wasn't a great player, wasn't a good player, was sort of a seventh man off the bench, but he hustled. He hustled his butt off. And Tommy loved him. So he would yell out, you know, "I love Walter." And that's my best Tommy impression, by the way, because he loved his hustle. And he created this thing called the Tommy Award and Tommy points because he would award it to the guy that, you know, would get down on the ground to go after the loose ball, or the guy that would hustle down the court on offense or defense. And, you know, Walter McCarty was really the personification of that. And that was really, you know, so Tommy was he bridged the gap between the 80s Celtics of Bird, McHale and Parrish to the early 2000s or 2010s, I guess, Celtics of Pierce and Garnett and Allen. And today's Celtics are obviously good too. But there was a number of years in between where, you know, the Celtics were hardly worth watching were it not for Tommy and, you know, finding the silver linings and celebrating the small victories. So, I mean, the Red Sox too, there was continuity, I guess, in the early 2000s. Those teams were all great. Those Theo Epstein teams, the Terry Francona teams, David Ortiz, obviously, a big part of those Red Sox championship teams of 2004, 2007. Ortiz was also part of the team that won in 2013. I would say that the Celtics and the Patriots really had a lot more continuity than the other teams. The Bruins have struggled with that sort of continuity. And that's sort of why that they're number four, I guess, in Boston anyway, in terms of, the passion of the fan. I mean, not the Bruins don't have a passionate fan base, but, the other three teams, are more popular, although the Red Sox have probably fallen off a cliff in that respect because of their last couple of seasons.
So Dave, we're near the end of this podcast, but I was wondering if we might be able to end with our thoughts on what Tommy Heinsohn means to each one of us. So maybe I could ask you to start.
Sure. So Tommy to me, and again, I knew Tommy really only as an announcer, and as the guy in the Miller Lite commercials, the Taste Great, Less Filling, that was paired up with a ref. He was arguing with a ref like he always does. Tommy to me, he brought joy to watching a Celtics game because you really felt that he bled green the same way you did. When you were standing up yelling at your TV, he was doing the same thing in the announcer booth, and he was yelling at the refs the same way that you were in your living room. And so he sort of he made it feel okay to be not okay, but he made it. I guess he made it mainstream for announcers to be partisan, and for fans to sort of accept that as a norm. Like, you like when you're watching a national broadcast, you expect the announcers to be nonpartisan. But when you're watching the home broadcast, like on your, you're watching the Celtics broadcast, you sort of want that partisanship. You want the announcers to be rooting along with you. And Tommy was the personification of that. He was really fantastic. And another thing about Tommy that I didn't know, honestly, until he passed away, was that he was also a great artist and he had a huge heart. His broadcast partner, Mike Gorman, who we broadcast with for over two decades, told a story on the radio the other day about, how Tommy went to Mike Gorman's wedding, and, almost a year had passed, and Mike Gorman's wife sort of said to him, "Huh, we never get a gift from Tommy for the wedding." And, Mike sort of blew it off, said, "Oh, Tommy's got a year, it doesn't matter, whatever." But then, shortly after, Mike Gorman got an invitation from Tommy to an art show somewhere on the North Shore in Massachusetts. And the featured piece in the art show was a painting that Tommy had painted of the inn where Mike Gorman was married. And that was his gift to Mike Gorman, his broadcast partner. He took almost a year to paint this gorgeous painting of the inn where he got married. So, And I just learned of this very recently. And, Mike Gorman can't tell the story without breaking down and crying a little bit. So Tommy meant a lot to players, to broadcasters, to fans. And I'm talking about players of almost every generation. If you look on social media the last couple of days since he passed away, you see messages from guys like Larry Bird and Paul Pierce, but also of current players like Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, Marcus Smart, people on today's Celtics. They saw him. He was still a mentor to them, even to this day. So Tommy was – he bled green. He was sort of Mr. Celtic. He was the guy that was a part of all 17 of their championships, and he'll always be remembered for that.
My reflections, first of all, I really felt like he was my main introduction to the NBA. And as I said, it was because he was a Tommy. So there's that. But the other thing is, and it's really, I think, reflected throughout this podcast, we have used the name Heinz, and I wrote it down four times. It's been Tommy for both of us. And that speaks to a level of intimacy. And to have that level of intimacy with literally a fan base from Boston to Houston speaks to a character of a man that I've really come to admire as I've researched for this podcast. But he was always just Tommy to me. And, yes, he was Mr. Celtic, but I got to see him in all of those roles. And to have that kind of relationship with, or what I would call now, what's your brand, for Tommy Heinsohn to have that kind of brand with Tom Fox really speaks to something we do not see very often. So, Dave, thank you for taking the time to visit with me to share some of your reflections of Tommy Heinsohn. And as much as I enjoy talking to you about Celtics basketball and Boston sports, I hope we don't have an occasion to do this anytime soon again.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate it. My pleasure.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. If you have any questions on this episode, you can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. I would greatly appreciate it if you would rate our podcast in iTunes, as it would help us increase our rankings and expanding our listener base for the oldest podcast in compliance. If you have any questions you'd like explored on this podcast, please send them to me as well, or you can leave them on the Compliance Podcast Network. The FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. I hope you'll join us again next week, where we take up another issue in FCPA and compliance. Thanks again for listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.